Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much, Virginia. And I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care workshop. And today's current workshop focuses on chemotherapy and new novel approaches to prevent and manage gastrointestinal treatment side effects. Today's program is supported by Taiho Oncology, Inc., an educational grant from Daiichi Sankyo, and I really want to thank them both for their support of this program. Now, before I introduce our first speaker, I have a few things I'd like to do. First of all, I want to let you know that there are over 203 participants on the call today, and you come from all over the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. We also happen to have a great many international participants from Afghanistan, Algeria, Canada, Ghana, India, Pakistan, Philippines, Romania, Taiwan, and the United Kingdom. So this is truly a global call, and we're delighted to have you on the call, all of you on the call today. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Richard Gralla. And Dr. Gralla is Professor of Medicine, Albert Einstein College of Medicine, Jacoby Medical Center. And he'll be addressing why chemotherapy causes treatment side effects and discomfort, including emesis, vomiting, working with your healthcare team to better understand and cope with potential treatment side effects, their plan to manage or prevent them, and common treatment gastrointestinal side effects. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Gralla.
Well, hello, and thank you, Carolyn. As Carolyn mentioned, I'm Dr. Richard Gralla. I'm a medical oncologist at Albert Einstein College of Medicine and Jacoby Medical Center in New York. I have the pleasure of introducing this program dealing with gastrointestinal or GI side effects of anti-cancer therapy. And also, there are many reasons why one can get GI side effects. We have several topics to focus on and a wonderful panel assembled today to address these issues. As we have a limited time and many topics to cover, if we don't answer all your questions on GI issues or don't get to your topic, please feel free to ask about it in the question and answer period that follows the presentations. My colleagues on the program are highly regarded worldwide, not only for their knowledge and experience, but also for their skills in delivering excellent care. I hope the discussions will be helpful to you and your family. Now, before we start, Carolyn often asks me to address the issue of COVID. It is still very much among us and can lead to quite distressing and even dangerous illness, especially for those with cancer and those in the older age groups. People taking care of individuals with cancer need to do everything to protect our loved ones and patients from cancer and influenza. I personally am very much up to date in my immunizations for COVID and flu and wouldn't think of seeing patients without being immunized and taking all precautions. Please have on hand tests for COVID. They're very easy to use. And if they do test positive, or if you think you might have COVID, speak with your doctor, and it may vary, and ask about Paxlovid, which can be quite helpful, and how to adjust your medicines if you're taking. Remarkable changes in cancer care, including new modalities of treatment and ways to prevent side effects, have occurred over the past several years. It's fair to say that we're in an evolutionary period of how to maximize the benefit of these newer methods. The emphasis these days is on the individual, that is you. This led to terms such as precision medicine based on individual factors and on the term patient-reported outcomes, or PROs. These patient-reported outcomes reflect that in many areas, only through fine communication with patients and family input can we as healthcare professionals understand fully the issues that need to be addressed. And this applies very much to GI toxicities. Are you having nausea? How is your appetite? Only you can answer these questions. There's no blood test or x-ray that will do this. With this communication, your care can be further individualized and maximized. While my colleagues will address many more issues, I'll start by talking about the prevention of nausea and vomiting. Patients and families have told us that control of nausea and vomiting with chemotherapy is at or top or near the top of their concerns. This is why it's worth our discussing this issue. In recent years, many improvements have occurred. It's a bit puzzling to me that this remarkable progress in preventing nausea and vomiting, also called emesis, is not well known by the general public or the news media or movies and the rest. It's safe to say that the majority of people getting anti-cancer treatment today will not experience vomiting from it or will have very little, although some will. So it's a remarkable change, but we need to know about it. So why is it that nausea and vomiting can occur with chemotherapy? Actually, nausea and vomiting are normal protective response. When you get a foreign chemical, such as chemotherapy, the body thinks that you ate it, didn't take it IV, and so the body has natural receptors that detect this in the gastrointestinal tract or in the bloodstream, and then the gut and the brain monitor these chemicals and lead to the very complicated reflex of nausea and vomiting. It's tricky, but it's an important reflex. But of course, when we are receiving chemotherapy, we want to turn off this reflex, and that's what our medicines do. So we know as healthcare professionals the mechanisms by which the body does this, and this gives us a targeted way on how to prevent emesis, which I'll describe in a minute. Again, if we can block these important receptors or sensors, we can prevent this side effect. Or if one's receiving radiation therapy, where it is directed and how much of an amount is given is also important to know whether we need to prevent nausea and vomiting. Let me start by describing a patient of mine who's quite representative of the issue. We need to think about the prevention of emesis in every patient who's receiving chemotherapy. I'll call her Mrs. Wilson. She's a 57-year-old woman who presented with advanced lung cancer with many symptoms. It was clear that she needed systemic therapy, which emphasizes chemotherapy and/or immunotherapy, and that she would be receiving several anti-cancer agents together, some of which have a high likelihood of causing nausea and vomiting. The goal is to prevent emesis, not to wait for it to happen. What individual factors would contribute to knowing the risk of our patient, Mrs. Wilson? First, the choice of the chemotherapy that she was about to receive. Oncologists and oncology nurses know that there are different risks of nausea and vomiting associated with different agents. This could lead to the use of no antiemetic agents if the risk is minimal, or one, two, or even four agents as prevention, depending on this. Second, for some reason, it's a little more difficult to control emesis in women than in men. Third, it can be more difficult to prevent emesis in younger people than in older people. This patient is middle-aged at 57, so her risk is about average. There are also some other factors too, but these are the main ones, and knowing these factors helps us as healthcare prevention professionals knowing whether to recommend an additional agents or not. We learned several years ago that certain serotonin receptors are important in the process, both in the GI tract and in the brain. Today, we can block these receptors with Ceftron drugs, which when used properly are very helpful and have few side effects for most people. I will discuss the side effects in just a bit. But these agents include commonly such as ondansetron, granisetron, and palonosetron, all of which have trade names such as Zofran, and Aloxi. We then learned that another pathway which is associated with a natural protein transmitter called substance P is also important. Medicines to address this pathway are called NK1 receptor antagonists, and they're also important. And like the Cetrons, they usually have very few side effects. These are medicines such as Emend or Akynzeo, using the common names. And an older class of medicines, those related to cortisone or corticosteroids, have an important role for many people, and most often used is dexamethasone or Decadron. Recently, it has been found that just one day of this medicine for many people can be as useful as multiple and can reduce side effects. Finally, an older medicine called olanzapine or Zyprexa can also be useful. This medicine is also a tranquilizer, but that's not the reason for using it. It has inherent anti-nausea properties. Anti-nausea and vomiting medicines, called antiemetics, are equally beneficial as preventatives when given orally or intravenously, and they're typically given shortly before the chemotherapy. But some agents may be given for a few days, even if the person's doing very well. I'm pleased to report that this patient, Mrs. Wilson, got three of these medicines right before each of four chemotherapy cycles and never was troubled with nausea or vomiting. While I mentioned that NK1 antagonists and Cetrons have few side effects, there are some worth mentioning. First is headache with the Cetrons. Usually it's minor. If you have it, a bit of Tylenol generally works pretty well. I always say if you're in doubt, go ahead and take the Tylenol. And if you're in doubt whether the headache was caused by this, it is really so simple when you're taking just one dose of the Tylenol. The second side effect is common. It is caused by the Cetrons, but is also very often seen in people with cancer getting a variety of medicines, and that's constipation. Please be aware. Always with constipation, the best strategy is to prevent it. Make sure you're taking enough fluid. You know you're taking enough fluid when you're urinating a bit more than usual, and that really helps prevent things. But if you are constipated with the Cetrons or otherwise, it is good to start with simple laxatives like Senna or Ducalax or Milk of Magnesia. You may need to increase the amount of these gradually to more than usual, and it is certainly something to discuss carefully with your doctor or nurse. Now, with stronger pain medicines such as opioids, constipation is very common. Absolutely discuss constipation if you're starting on these medicines or if you're constipated and you've had these medicines with your doctor and nurse. You may very well need to take laxatives, as I mentioned, such as prevention, or move up the type of laxatives, including medicines such as Miralax and similar. In some instances with the opioids, an additional prescription medicine such as methylnaltrexone is needed, and this is for people who have tried other things, are getting themselves well hydrated, but are still constipated. So it's really important to keep in mind the prevention and the early treatment of these things. Now, getting back to my patient, she also receives an immune oncology agent called the checkpoint inhibitor for the many cycles, but fortunately, the checkpoint inhibitors almost never cause emesis. And when she received this agent, she did not take an antiemetic and had no nausea or vomiting. Finally, some pointers on anti-nausea care. Remember, these medicines are given to prevent the problem rather than waiting for it to occur, depending on the risk, which we discussed. So be sure that you fully understand your doctor or nurse's instructions for taking the anti-nausea medicines just right, or they may give them to you right there at the treatment center while you're getting your chemo. Make sure you have the proper medicines and a sufficient supply. If you're diabetic and you're taking the corticosteroids, you may need to be particularly attentive to your blood sugar levels and to your fluid and food intake. Be sure to go over this with your healthcare team. And be sure that you are keeping up with fluids, just as we mentioned. Now, I know that Ms. Clark Snow will be the next speaker. as a partial introduction of her. She is one of the best-known oncology nurses, not just in the U.S., but internationally, since we have an international group of participants today. And she's so well-known because of her contributions in lung cancer, breast cancer, and especially in supportive care. Now, I'll now turn the program back to Carolyn Messner, and we'll look forward to the presentations of my colleagues, which are coming right up. Carolyn?
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Grala. That was a wonderful presentation. Just really stellar. And you also set the stage for today's program. I can't thank you enough and for the role you played in planning this program as well. So thank you so much. And we do have a star-studded cast of speakers today, and it's a tribute to Dr. Grala in recommending each of them. So our next speaker is Ms. Rebecca Clark Snow. She is an oncology supportive care consultant. Her topics will be how healthcare teams approach management and prevention of these common GI side effects, including anorexia, diet, weight gain or weight loss, the role of the oncology nurse in preventing GI side effects, and communicating with the healthcare team about quality of life concerns. And I have to say that I think Dr. Grala did a wonderful job introducing Ms. Clark Snow. She's amazing. And I'm going to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Rebecca Clark Snow.
Well, thank you, Dr. Messner. I appreciate those kind words, and special thanks to Dr. Grala for that introduction and for his very informative talk. So I especially like to thank you for this invitation to discuss a topic of concern to patients, caregivers, and healthcare providers during this afternoon's Cancer Care Workshop. Everyone discussing a topic that is of particular interest and concern today appreciates the participation of those who've called into this teleconference. And it is our hope that it will provide useful information, ideas, and perhaps stimulate questions that you may take back to your oncologists, oncology nurses, and support team members to discuss further. My focus this afternoon will be to discuss anorexia or decreased appetite. One of the pleasures that we all enjoy is visiting with family and friends and enjoying meals together. It is how we show our love for each other while especially enjoying the fellowship of eating, visiting with each other, and sharing thoughts and experiences. It is one of the many ways we balance our daily lives. However, this very same balance is often disrupted when a loved one or friend has been given a cancer diagnosis. Very often, anorexia or loss of appetite may be one of many symptoms patients present with, and is also quite common as a side effect of treatment, often related to nausea and vomiting, as an example, as Dr. Grala mentioned. It therefore becomes an issue that is critical to early identification and offering treatment options. Anorexia or decreased appetite in patients with cancer is multifactorial. This afternoon, I will outline some of the causes of this disturbing symptom, how it is assessed and identified, interventions, how patients are monitored, and how a multidisciplinary approach can provide patients with the best possible opportunity for improved outcomes. It is not all uncommon during an initial cancer diagnosis for patients to present with weight loss and some degree of a lack of appetite. This is most notably observed in patients with gastrointestinal cancers who present with weight loss and issues related to adequate nutritional intake. It's been reported that approximately 80% of patients with GI cancers experience weight loss even when they have a good performance status. A cancer diagnosis may cause a complicated medical response that impacts appetite, resulting in distress, and a reduced desire to eat, and maintaining an adequate dietary intake and nutrition. Some mechanisms and causes of anorexia and cancer can include the following: severe pain, gastroparesis or delayed emptying of stomach contents, early satiety, as I mentioned, nausea and vomiting, and notably chronic nausea, depression, dysgeusia or an altered taste perception, constipation, gastrointestinal obstruction, some comorbid conditions including thyroid dysfunction, vitamin deficiencies such as vitamin B12 and vitamin D, dysphagia or difficulty swallowing, mucositis or mouth sores, which Dr. Epstein will discuss with you in more detail, and certainly medications including chemotherapy and pain meds. Additionally, poor oral hygiene may be one of the things that may affect a patient's desire to eat. Appetite and weight loss are associated with important clinical outcomes such as fewer completed cycles of chemotherapy, more treatment-related side effects, and a poorer health-related quality of life. It is therefore extremely important that patients at risk be identified early in order to provide the greatest opportunity for effective intervention. Any delays could potentially result in not providing appropriate counseling and treatment. An important point that we as healthcare providers must also be aware of is that anorexia may not always be identified by healthcare providers, and some patients may be hesitant to report symptoms related to their diagnosis. So our goals for patient assessment of anorexia include identifying patients at risk for anorexia, screening all patients for eating-related concerns, identification of early signs, making referrals as needed, including nutritional consults and dental consults, and being certain that these appropriate appointments are not only made, but kept by your patients. Identifying a treatment plan and monitoring outcomes of intervention. Now, there's no standard to diagnose anorexia, so thorough questioning to determine its presence and the degree of loss of appetite compared to normal is accomplished initially by nurses and physicians. Assessment should ideally be obtained early at diagnosis prior to starting treatment, possibly using institutional questionnaires, checklists, or established assessment tools, and must be followed up continuously in order to make diet modifications if needed. Now, to date, there are no evidence-based guidelines for the identification and treatment of anorexia, so the management and clinical assessment of patients either identified at risk or who have been diagnosed with anorexia should focus on nutrient intake, symptoms contributing to poor oral intake, weight and body composition if necessary, and identification of reversible metabolic abnormalities. And we must follow through with a comprehensive plan to address each of these critical areas. A multidisciplinary team approach, which incorporates recommendations endorsed by professional oncology, nursing, medical, and nutrition organizations in the U.S., provide institutions and healthcare providers with comprehensive interventions to assist patients while navigating through the cancer continuum. Once again, these supportive interventions highlight the importance of the following principles to optimize clinical practice. Number one, physician oncology nutrition at the center of multidisciplinary care. Secondly, partner with colleagues and administrators to integrate a nutrition care process into a multidisciplinary cancer care approach. Thirdly, screen all patients for anorexia, malnutrition risk at diagnosis. Fourthly, to combine exercise and nutrition interventions before, during, and after treatment as an oncology standard of care. And lastly, to incorporate a patient-centered approach into multidisciplinary care. I've mentioned a multidisciplinary approach to managing anorexia, and it should include the following. A nutrition screening initiated by oncology nurses, ideally to be completed at diagnosis, as I mentioned earlier, and recorded in the electronic medical record for all healthcare providers to be aware of and to have access to. A nutrition assessment initiated by physicians and dietitians using validated tools with relevant information and results communicated to the multidisciplinary care team. The role of the dietitian or nutritionist is one of collaborative problem solving, building rapport with patients and caregivers via psychosocial support to include empathy, reliable provision of care, and the delivery of a positive perspective, and offering viable choices such as nutritional substances, supplements, and dietary tips whenever possible. Patient monitoring should be accomplished by physicians, nurses, and dietitians, with reevaluations to be scheduled at regular intervals. Any changes affecting the patient's medical status should be communicated to the multidisciplinary care team. Patient teaching by nurses and dietitians is paramount and must be reinforced during clinic visits and phone call follow-ups. Practical nutritional advice for patients will include the following. Eating whenever you feel like eating. I think that's really important. Taking advantage of the times you're hungriest. Consider eating your largest meal of the day then. Make meals enjoyable by eating in a pleasant atmosphere with family and friends. And meals should never be forced, but presented in a nurturing and helpful manner. Eating small, frequent meals or snacks. Having nutritious snacks handy to easily grab during the day. Considering light exercise before a meal, which may stimulate appetite. Always drink plenty of fluids between meals, not necessarily during meals. And have protein drinks handy if recommended to use as supplements. Maintaining regular bowel function. And also allowing each patient to have enough rest, adequate rest is also important. Written materials, if available, should always be discussed and given to patients and loved ones that can easily be accessed and referred to if necessary, as well as a list of organizations or other materials that can be reviewed online. In conclusion, patients who experience a loss of appetite at initial diagnosis, during treatment, at the conclusion of treatment or beyond, must be reassured that every attempt to restore or improve their appetite will be explored. Although certainly well-meaning, this very common and prevalent issue may place a significant strain on patients, loved ones, and family interactions. It is therefore important to involve all those who care for a loved one in the best treatment options available. Treatment of anorexia should be individualized, taking into consideration the patient's overall condition, principal mechanisms of their weight loss, and the patient's goals for care. The approach should be multidisciplinary with frequent follow-up and reevaluation of current treatment as needed. As healthcare providers, we must also be sensitive to cultural differences among patients that could possibly influence advice and treatment plans. Patients and caregivers should feel confident in the care and information they are receiving and always feel comfortable contacting any of the team members with questions or concerns. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you very much. That was just a remarkable presentation. Ms. Clark Snow, that was just excellent, and you provided so many suggestions and tips for our participants. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, so just amazing, and also very lots of information, but lots of compassion as you presented it as well, which I think means the world to our participants. So thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Lee Schwartzberg. And Dr. Schwartzberg is Chief, Medical Oncology and Hematology, Renowned Institute for Cancer, Professor of Clinical Medicine, University of Nevada, Reno. And Dr. Schwartzberg will be addressing novel agents to treat diarrhea, the importance of clinical trials, how research increases your treatment options, guidelines to prepare for telehealth, telemedicine appointments, including technology, prepared list of questions, and discussion of open notes. It's my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Schwartzberg.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. It's a real privilege and pleasure to be here today with all of you and to be with my colleagues, all of whom I've worked with for a long period of time and have seen the remarkable advances that have occurred over time in cancer care, as Dr. Grala mentioned at the beginning of our program. One of the things we've seen over the last couple of decades is an acceleration of new drugs that are coming into the market that and approved by the FDA that allows us to treat cancer in much more effective ways than we did before. As mentioned, many of these drugs are targeted therapies or biological therapies, and others are immunotherapies. And in many cases, we're replacing traditional chemotherapy, but traditional chemotherapy still does play a role in most of the common cancers and is often used in at some point in a patient's journey with cancer. So we need to think about all of the toxicities, and today, of course, our focus is on GI toxicities, and I'm going to drill down into what's called chemotherapy-induced diarrhea, diarrhea that relates to cancer therapy more broadly. This is a very common toxicity. In fact, many of our treatments, including many of the newer treatments that have been developed that help our patients so wonderfully, these treatments, in some cases, over 3 out of 4 or over 75% of patients will experience some diarrhea with. The problem with diarrhea is multifactorial. Once you have diarrhea from your cancer therapy, it may cause a poor quality of life. And one of the goals of cancer therapy is to maintain or improve quality of life while also treating the cancer and hopefully increasing the quantity of life as well. They're both exceedingly important. So we don't want a therapy to reduce your quality of life, reduce your ability to perform normal activities, and have a negative effect not just on your physical functioning, but also on emotional functioning. If you can't get to the dinner with your family that Becky so eloquently talked about, that's going to be an uncomfortable and disappointing thing for you. More seriously, diarrhea can lead to consequences on your health that are substantial, like hospitalizations for dehydration, a higher cost to you and to the system. And then in many cases, unfortunately, if diarrhea is not controlled from your cancer therapy, that therapy may need to be reduced or even discontinued, and therefore can have a downstream effect on how well you do with your cancer if you can't get an otherwise effective therapy. So this is a serious problem, and unfortunately it's a growing problem because, again, many of the newer therapies are causing this. We have a large number of drugs that cause diarrhea. That includes some of the traditional IV chemotherapy drugs that we use in the past and many of the targeted therapies. And I'll just mention a few of the IV drugs that are commonly used for some of the common cancers that cause diarrhea frequently. In the GI cancers, we use a drug called irinotecan and an older drug that we've used in many different types of cancers called 5-fluorouracil. Are two of the drugs that cause commonly cancer. And these drugs, like other cytotoxic or cell-killing chemotherapy drugs, seem to directly affect the lining cells of the intestine. We can see two different phases of diarrhea with these drugs when they're given together and typically in combination, or sometimes with other drugs like platinum agents. We can see early diarrhea, and that's defined as diarrhea that occurs within 24 hours, often immediately after receiving it. And we have a specific therapy for that, which is giving atropine, a drug that can be given intravenously to prevent that. But most drugs cause later diarrhea, not something you're going to get immediately. And that's particularly true for the newer agents, which are called TKIs or targeted therapies. We see these used a lot in many different cancers now, lung cancer, breast cancer, colorectal cancer, and others. And many of these drugs will cause diarrhea, usually relatively early after you start them. These are oral drugs for the most part, and they're taken typically daily. And diarrhea often begins in the first couple of weeks after starting, not the day that you start these drugs, but not months later typically. So the period of risk for many of these agents is in those first few weeks that you take it. Now, how do we define diarrhea? I think it's important to remember that everyone has different bowel habits, and your normal is what your normal is. And somebody might have a bowel movement every day or every 2 days or 3 days, or some people might have one, two, or three bowel movements a day. So it's important to talk to your doctor about what your baseline bowel habits are. Then from there, low-grade diarrhea would be defined as a couple of extra bowel movements per day. Once you get into more than three or four extra bowel movements a day, that's really considered moderate diarrhea. And of course, if it keeps going up, or if you get dehydrated or even need to go to the hospital, that's severe diarrhea. And we obviously want to prevent that as much as possible. If you do get diarrhea after starting a new agent or being on a chemotherapy or a targeted oral therapy, it's important for your doctor to consider other causes, because the treatment itself may be the reason and frequently is the reason, but we can't rule out other reasons like infection, and sometimes it's important to get a culture of the stool. There are other drugs that can cause diarrhea by different mechanisms. And Dr. Grala mentioned immunotherapy, which has transformed the treatment of many cancers. That can cause colitis or inflammation of the colon, and that is treated very differently than other chemotherapy-induced diarrhea. So that's important to let anybody who's evaluating your diarrhea in the emergency room or your physician or your care team to know the drugs that you're on. Also, if you have fever with diarrhea, that's less likely to be a direct chemo effect, although it does occur. And sometimes a gastroenterologist should get involved. How do we treat diarrhea that's caused from chemotherapy? We do have some non-pharmacologic or non-drug ways of doing that, and diet is good, the so-called BRAT diet, bananas, rice, applesauce, and toast, but that should only be used for a day or two because it's not nutritious. You can frequently go on a long-term bland diet with lean proteins and non-gassy vegetables and carrots and potatoes, for example, and low-fiber fruit. That's a good strategy if you have a tendency towards diarrhea and you're taking a drug that's more common. There's been some preliminary work on probiotics that look encouraging, but we don't know for sure. And then there are other techniques which haven't been proven. For treatment, typically, we recommend patients who are starting a drug that may cause diarrhea, an over-the-counter medication called loperamide, which decreases the motility or the movement of your intestines. And this can be used effectively in low to intermediate-grade diarrhea. You can take that up to 4 to 6 times a day. If it doesn't work or you become resistant, there's another drug called Lomotil, which is a prescription that's more heavier narcotic and an anticholinergic and can cause more symptoms but can be effective. Sometimes patients even need to get an injection of another drug called octreotide, which can be given under the skin or intravenous. Unfortunately, There are no definitive preventative strategies yet for that, like we have for nausea and emesis. We don't have that for diarrhea, but there are many drugs now that are in clinical trials that hopefully will help us with that. A lot of people ask these days about the microbiome. There's been a lot of work on the gut microbiome, and it probably does play a role, but we don't understand it fully yet. I would encourage anyone to, if they're offered a trial, to look at adjusting gut microbiome. We need to learn a lot more about that. But right now, we can think about using probiotics, which shouldn't hurt, but we don't know yet for sure they help. The last thing I want to say is being forewarned is forearmed. So you should meet with a dietitian if you're starting a drug. You should maintain fluid balance, as Becky talked about, and we really should do this as much as possible when you're taking when you're getting any diarrhea. It seems that exercise may help you. Most importantly is education. Know when your diarrhea may occur, and very, very importantly, do not hesitate to call your care team. Don't worry if it's Friday evening and you want to wait till Monday morning. Call. You're in trouble if you diarrhea gets worse and might require hospitalization if you wait too long, because it can often get worse. So don't hesitate. All of our care teams in cancer care are available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And we need to hear from you if you get any symptoms, not just diarrhea. If you're concerned, we're concerned. And start treating when they're early in the symptom will be more effective than waiting. I've gone long, so I think I'll stop there. And I just want to thank you again for your attention. And we'll take some questions in a little while. Carolyn?
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Schwartzberg. That was just a phenomenal presentation, wonderful information for our participants. And, of course, there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. So thank you so much. This is great. We definitely have a star-studded group of speakers today. And our next speaker is Dr. Joel Epstein. And Dr. Epstein is a diplomat, American Board of Oral Medicine, consulting staff, Division of Otolaryngology and Head and Neck Surgery, City of Hope Cancer, California. And Dr. Epstein will be addressing current research and directions to improve control of GI treatment side effects, including stomatitis, mouth sores, and other oral conditions, developing a detailed plan with the oncology team to manage and prevent GI chemotherapy treatment side effects, and the importance of being prepared before treatment starts. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Epstein.
Well, thanks so much. I am pleased to be here with all the previous speakers and, of course, with the participants as the audience. I'm not sure if this was organized in order of our location from east to west in the United States with me last, or if interestingly, I am following diarrhea and I'm at the beginning of the GI tract. So, of course, it's in essence been described as one tube start to finish, but there clearly are differences and different issues that patients present. So I'm happy to be part of this discussion. I will emphasize some aspects specifically related to oral, but all of these cross over because it is the GI tract. And many of the comments made previously have been particularly helpful. I will focus mostly on mucositis, but I will mention some of the other side effects that should be addressed. Just to reiterate what others have said, the oral ulcerations that are associated with cancer therapy were essentially identified in direct relationship to cytotoxic or cell damaging therapies, that is radiation for local, regional, head and neck, oral cancers, but also chemotherapy for systemic cancers. The changes have been in the targeted therapies, which have different mechanisms by which oral complications arise, and certainly the immune checkpoint drugs, which have been mentioned throughout, also different mechanisms. Interestingly, this is creating a more complex environment, obviously with the goal of better cancer outcomes, but also creating different mechanisms of action that may be leading to oral tissue damage. The treatments then will probably need to be much more directed at these specific therapies. Already we are doing some things for different potential causes and the different presentations that are associated with these different groups of therapies. The beginning stage, and this is broadly in oncology care in general, it should involve what we might describe as prehabilitation, meaning a dental evaluation with a knowledgeable dentist, and local treatment of any of the acute needs that may become complications either during therapy or long-term in some of the local regional treatments for head and neck cancer, but also in bone marrow transplant in particular. The prehabilitation would then include dealing with acute needs, emphasizing oral hygiene, and thanks to Dr. Schwartzberg, who emphasized microbiome, that is an area of increasing interest, not just GI, and secondarily now oral, and the oral microbiome may play a much more significant role in both oral complications and specifically in mucosal damage or mucositis. That is being investigated, but we're just at the beginning of that process. In fact, somewhere behind the GI tract related investigation and management. So in a mucositis model, there may be different types of presentations, one that is associated with acute cancer care. That's what most people discuss when they use the term mucositis. And this would be occurring in close proximity or during the therapy. People are often potentially or frequently seen during this phase. Some are hospitalized and many are outpatients. And they can be managed with basic protocols that include oral hygiene maintenance, the use of pain medicines when pain is present, and then directed interventions that may have an impact upon the mechanisms at play when mucosal damage in the oral cavity occurs. And this can include, and our best evidence currently, is red and infrared light therapy. It is listed as a level 1-2 evidence level, which is close to the highest we can obtain for prevention. Interestingly, the mechanism is thought to be improving the biology of the cell function to maintain, in this case, the oral tissue barrier as intact. But also it may have effects directly on pain management. This therapy is gaining traction. The evidence is quite strong, but the uptake in institutions is slower than we might expect based upon the evidence, but this is increasing in various cancer treatment centers. There are some other agents, one that has been available for some time, and that's Kepivance, which may improve biology of both salivary gland function and mucosal protection, but this has not had a large uptake, potentially due to side effects and cost. And then most of the other treatments look at either local applications on the surface in the form of rinses or other products. And one that's not available in the United States, and we have a worldwide audience with a good level of evidence of effectiveness, is benzidamine, which is a non-ulcerogenic anti-inflammatory NSAID drug. Considerable work is still continuing with some supplements, including glutamine, honey, and then specific agents for the cytotoxic therapy is ongoing. On the targeted and an immune checkpoint inhibitor oral complications, this typically involves a topically applied anti-inflammatory based upon suppressing white blood cells that may come to the area causing tissue damage. And that may include the potential value of red and infrared light, as well as drugs that are preventing cytokines that cause inflammation, and that's anti-TNF drugs. So this is dealing with the acute phase, but just to complete a brief sort of run through on mucositis, this can be chronic, this can be recurrent, so that there's a condition called recall mucositis when other toxicities may occur and the same mucosal lesion recurs months to even years later. And the immune checkpoint drugs are used potentially on a chronic basis, and the immune mucosal reactions may develop months to even, as far as we can understand, even years with other triggers triggering the mucosal damage. So just to finish a list of other complications that I think should at least be mentioned is mucosal damage is causing pain. Neurologic effects may present as neuropathic pain symptoms that include burning, and also a neurologic function that is critical is taste function, and that can be directly impacted by both mucositis itself, by the impact of these drugs. And lastly, just to mention that dry mouth management is important in tissue repair, healing, and maintaining the microbiome. This requires an assessment of quantity and quality of saliva. So what I will end with, because I think we have a wrap-up to come, is that the mouth is a part of the body. And for the dental world, even though we do a lot of dental extractions and we have successfully extracted the mouth from the rest of the body, it plays a significant role. The mechanisms are similar, and we're part of getting comfort, nutrition, and all the social and health aspects of that to patients. So I will end with that and be present for any questions that may come up.
Thank you. I know there'll be questions to you during the Q&A. And now we're going to move on to the Q&A. So, Regina, if you would please explain to the audience how to queue up for questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we'll take questions from the web only, and you may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
So this question for Dr. Grala, is there any specific type of cold glove to reduce the possibility of neuropathy in the hands and feet?
Well, this is not a GI side effect, but I guess we'll proceed. The treatment of peripheral neuropathy or the prevention of peripheral neuropathy is not very effective. First of all, people have used drugs like gabapentin, but they have not really proven to be effective as either prevention or as treatment. There is some use of cold therapies such as to prevent hair loss, and there is some evidence that there can be some value of using gloves and other things that have been chilled ahead of time. I don't find that these are used very much, and in prevention it's particularly difficult because you would end up for peripheral neuropathy in the hands with drugs such as taxanes or vinca alkaloids in having an unpleasant effect for many people who would never develop that issue. And so I don't find that that's used very often, but sometimes in people who have already developed some neuropathy, I have seen it used, and there is some evidence that it can be helpful.
Thank you. And for Dr. Schwartzberg, how can I prepare myself for nausea before chemotherapy? Are there preferred foods to eat prior to an appointment?
I think both for nausea and for diarrhea, potentially changing a diet when you're starting a medicine that might cause either of those is important. So a bland diet can be used frequently. So getting away from very spicy foods and foods that are hard to digest that can cause problems with abdominal cramping and gassy foods, those are the ones to try to avoid for sure. One thing that everyone should keep in mind is that your taste buds frequently change during chemotherapy. Some of the foods that you like may not taste good to you, and you might develop a craving for a food that traditionally you didn't like, and that's okay. That's typically a side effect that is short-lived and reflects the taste buds changing to chemotherapy just like many other tissues. But you should think actively about what your diet is going to be once you're starting a new therapy in case the really very effective anti-nausea drugs don't work or if you do have a tendency towards diarrhea.
Thank you. And we're just going to have the takeaways now for Dr. Epstein, if you could just provide a takeaway before.
Great. Thank you very much. Great program, and just happy to be here. So what I would say as a takeaway is that many in the dental community have no experience in or training in cancer care management or an understanding. And the way to find the best supportive care is to look for cancer centers up front that work with comprehensive teams and that, as you heard from today's talk, can and should include oral care management specifically, also dental, but maybe more specific in some of these cases, specialty oral medicine level support. And that is present in many of the larger cancer centers. The cancer center is a good place to contact for recommendations of maybe community dentists that they work with who also would have a better understanding. And lastly, there's a hospital training program that's 1 year after dental school that is pretty popular, and there are people throughout the country that have had training, and that's called the Hospital General Practice Dental Residency. So again, they'll have greater familiarity with working in teams with physicians with the medical condition. So that is probably one of the best ways to access that. There's also support groups that everybody can look up. And just one last comment is many of the recommendations that are continuing to be developed are supported and organized through the Multinational Association for Supportive Care in Cancer, which is an international organization. And within that, for the oral care aspects, there's an oral care study group, and there's also a mucositis or study group that develops guidelines by a large literature review and some prospective evaluation. So those are places for resources, and that's one way to access the support that people may have trouble finding.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Epstein. Thank you so much. And a takeaway from Dr. Grava.
My takeaway is to remember a couple of simple things. One, please feel free to communicate carefully with your healthcare team, your nurse, your doctor, both. Social workers. This is the first thing to do. And then to remember that in many instances of all the side effects that we have been talking about, prevention is often a good idea. Prevention including taking proper medicine such as antiemetics prior to receiving the chemotherapy, which your healthcare team is fully aware of. Looking at making sure your hydration is good, and many of those hints that Ms. Clark Snow gave us as well in ways of trying to address appetite issues before they become too significant. So let's be thinking ahead, think with our teams, and feel free to ask good questions. That's my straightforward takeaway.
Thank you so much, Dr. Grella. And Ms. Rebecca Clark-Snow, your takeaway?
Well, I probably just would continue what Dr. Grella left off with, and that is that anorexia is not an uncommon occurrence in patients with cancer. It's distressing for patients, for family members, not being able to eat what you'd like, when you'd like to, but the important thing is that, you know, a significant weight loss is not something that certainly patients want or your oncologist or oncology nurse. So it's important to work with your oncology team to look for ways to help this become not a major issue, as it can definitely influence how you travel through your treatment course. There are several things that can be done. There are supplements available, other options, but the important thing is, as Dr. Grawl and everyone else mentioned, is to communicate whenever you feel it's necessary with your oncology team, and they likewise will also be asking you questions each and every time you visit, whether it's in the clinic or during chemotherapy. The chemotherapy nurses will also discuss these things with you, whether you're receiving radiation. Everyone is concerned about your welfare and to see that you successfully go through your treatment with as few side effects and problems as possible.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Excellent. And Dr. Schwarzberg.
Sure. I'll just continue the theme that my colleagues have so excellently discussed and just add that an informed patient is more likely to be a really successful patient. So the more you know about your disease and particularly about any treatment that you're getting and when to anticipate potential side effects and is going to make things better. And of course, talking to your healthcare team, as all of us have said, in a timely fashion. Education. All of us and every cancer center has individuals who will and should sit down with you and have a very comprehensive discussion of what could happen with any new drug that you're taking or just from the cancer itself. Now, of course, no one person gets all of the side effects, and that's not the point to scare you. It's to just inform you. And so that you'll remember if something happens, oh, they talked to me about this, and it's time for me to discuss it with them. So just as others have said, excellent communication both ways with your care team is the key to success.
Oh, thank you so much. What a great note for that takeaway to end on. Thank you. I think this has been an extraordinary program. And I would say that it's been extraordinary because actually we have such a remarkable participants today, and we also have such remarkable speakers. And I think although we've done this program before, I think this is the very best of one we've ever done before. I think that the speakers and participants really were asked such really great questions. Now, I do want to comment, because there were so many of you, we couldn't take all of your questions. So I do want to say a few words about that. For those of you who had a chance to ask a question, and for those of you who have questions yet in queue, I would advise all of you to take your questions back to your treating healthcare team. You know, they know you the best, and ask your questions again of your healthcare team. You've learned a lot today, and what you've learned will help inform your questions and help you also better understand your oncology team's responses to you. And if you need to ask the questions again and again, go right ahead. I mean, the more often you ask it, the better. Actually, it's really important. And I also would like to go over with you a few of the services that Cancer Care offers. Cancer Care is an organization that has a number of services that might be helpful to you. First of all, we're a national organization. We provide services throughout the country. We also have these workshops, lots of them per year. We have publications and fact sheets. But we also offer online support groups and practical and financial assistance to people in the United States and Copay Foundation. So there are a lot of services you can get from Cancer Care, and the best way to reach us is by calling 1-800-813-4673. Or visiting our website at www.cancercare.org. And the other thing is that, you know, the most important thing is to know that you're not alone, that you have a whole healthcare team behind you. And no matter what your experience is, we want you to be sure that you know, really take advantage of all the services that you get access. And what we'll do is you'll be getting a SurveyMonkey evaluation next week from us. It's an evaluation of the program, but we'll also include any resources that we've mentioned during the program, websites, any sorts of resources that we think will be helpful to you. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone have a great day.